Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the just-released report by the Dutch-led joint investigation team into the shootdown of a Malaysian airliner over eastern Ukraine in 2014 that killed all 298 people aboard. David Gleave, a chief investigator for aviation safety and an expert with the Transportation Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK, joins us to look into the enormous amount of evidence compiled by the Dutch, Australian, Belgian, Malaysian and Ukrainian investigators and prosecutors, which involved sifting through thousands of pieces of debris, 150,000 intercepted phone calls and 500,000 photographs. While the report promises to later identify suspects and determine who gave the orders, it does conclusively prove the Russian Buk missile was trucked in from Russia at the request of the Russian-backed separatists in Ukraine, then returned to Russia that same night after shooting down the passenger plane. Then we'll examine the overwhelming 97-1 vote in the Senate today to override President Obama's veto of the Schumer-Cornyn bill that was followed by a 338-74 vote in the House to allow the families of the victims of 9/11 to sue the government of Saudi Arabia for possible involvement in and sponsorship of the 9/11 attacks. Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, before the 9/11 attacks, joins us to discuss the importance of the families of the victims getting their day in court, because it will be the only way that evidence about an alleged role of Saudi Arabia in the attacks could be presented to the public and evaluated. Then finally, Gregory Gores, Chair and Professor of International Affairs at Texas A&M University and author of Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence, joins us to discuss the Obama administration's concerns having suffered their first veto override, that the legislation, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, which defines an American exemption to sovereign immunity, could backfire and expose the American government, its military, its citizens and corporations to lawsuits abroad. And joining us now from Dubai is David Gleave, a chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the United Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Gleave.
Glad to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, David. And the Dutch-led investigation has concluded into the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner over Ukraine 2 years ago, has concluded that the surface-to-air Buk missile that killed all 298 people on board was trucked in from Russia at the request of the separatists that Russia is backing and returned to Russia the same night. And the team of prosecutors, investigators come from the Netherlands, Australia, Belgium, Malaysia, and Ukraine. And this report is fairly meticulous, and it looks like they have a insider who was escorting the missile itself from Russia into Ukraine and back again that same night. So what do you make of the report so far?
Well, certainly the original accident investigation, which reported some time ago, defined that it was a Buk missile. And I've spoken to several of the investigators on that particular thing. And undoubtedly, there was a very comprehensive amount of research done to prove that it was that individual missile. Then after that, we moved on to where did the missile originate from. And by gathering lots of different radar tape, we were able to see differences between radar tape submitted to the various investigations. Some would indicate that the missile came from one area, whereas others were trying to indicate that the missile came from somewhere else. So there looks as if, together with some very interesting photographs released by the Russian media showing an aeroplane that couldn't climb to the relevant altitude to shoot the aeroplane down, being blamed for shooting the aeroplane down, as if we have a propaganda campaign of disinformation from one side and what could appear to be a logical set of well-corroborated evidence, including intelligence information, telephone calls that have been monitored, radar information, military analysis, and eyewitness statements on the other. So it really is beginning to look, at least within the Western world, that we can trust this report And so there were very early indications that a missile launcher had moved into the area and moved back out again. It was just uncredited sources from the intelligence agencies saying that that had been the movement. Now we're beginning to get an official report in the public domain using that type of information and saying that it is credible, accurate, and can be trusted.
And the original report that you referred to, David Gleave, was essentially a technical report that didn't look into culpability, but this one does. And they have listed over 150,000 intercepted telephone calls and examined 500,000 photographs. But it seems that some of the more damning and conclusive evidence of Russia's involvement in the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner is the fact that the missile struck right near the cockpit, just behind the pilots. They were the first to die. And the inside the bodies of one of the pilots was a butterfly-shaped piece of shrapnel, which is the type that's inside of the warhead in that particular Buk missile that's in the Russian arsenal, but it's not a part of the older Buk missile that the Ukrainians have. And of course, the Russians immediately said it was a Ukrainian Buk missile, not one of theirs. So that seems to be pretty conclusive. What's your impression?
The original investigation was very clear that it was a Buk missile, and then there was some discrediting from the Russian side about the fact that the Ukrainians had the early model warhead, which didn't have the butterfly piece within the shrapnel that it spits out when it gets in close proximity to the aeroplane. So there was some quite distinctive butterfly markings for impacting the aeroplane, as well as actually finding a piece within one of the pilots during the pathological examination afterwards. So in that sense, it was often regarded as a missile that had come from Russian stock rather than Ukrainian stock. But within the remit of the aircraft accident investigators, it wasn't theirs to really be able to say and trace the missile back without further evidence. They were more looking at what was the cause of the crash, which was obviously some form of missile, and what lessons could be learned from commercial aviation from this, and several were learnt indeed. After that, they then passed the investigation off to the criminal aspect, because this was obviously a case of mass murder, depending on your political interpretation of the event.
Well, indeed, that is where I believe there is evidence that's been compiled of actually who is culpable, and that would be the next stage. That is pretty much the indication I have. Is that, do you see that being in the next step, that they're actually going to start naming names and indicting people?
I think at this stage that there's two separate areas. First of all, there is the political acceptance that the missile was from Russian stock. It should have been controlled by the Russian politicians, effectively, through their military generals, and therefore the state of Russia has some reason to pay compensation to those on board the aeroplane. After that, you then look at the criminal cases, and you would then be looking at some form of murder, or possibly, in other countries, they may call it manslaughter, depending on whether that individual aircraft was intentionally shot down or whether it was a mistake to shoot at that aircraft because they thought it was another type of aeroplane. So within the investigation, they will have to be quite clear as to whether they thought that is Malaysia 17, we wish to shoot that aeroplane down, or whether they thought that was a manoeuvring Ukrainian aeroplane that was a legitimate target within their eyes, within the political conflict that they have at the moment. But undoubtedly, there is some form of homicide charges that will be laid, hopefully, against various people that made the decision to release the missile. But at the end of the day, they need to be able to get access to those people who may not be extraditable from the area. So it could well be a long process, but the International War Crimes Committee or whatever their exact name is, within The Hague in the Netherlands, has a long history of taking a long time, being very, very meticulous, and eventually prosecuting people for war crimes. And this may well be regarded as a war crime within their jurisdiction.
And again, I'm speaking with David Gleave, who's a chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University. He joins us from Dubai. Well, clearly, Russia is already starting to issue disinformation and denials. And of course, Russia already vetoed a Dutch-backed request to the United Nations some time back to establish an international tribunal, which would, you know, basically immunize everybody from any kind of notion that this is biased. But it does seem that given the parties involved in here, they're all the ones who lost people aboard the plane, and from where it just took off, and from the company Malaysia, who owned the airliner, it does seem to be, as you mentioned, the Hague is a very deliberative process. But will we end up with people being charged in absentia if indeed, as these investigators in this new report said, that they are going to start identifying suspects and determining who gave orders?
Well, I think it's a two-stage process. First of all, you have to be able to say politically which side released it and therefore focus your efforts and media attention from there. But part of this is, of course, to be able to explain to the relatives of those tragically killed on board the aeroplane exactly what happened so that they can bring peace and closure, or at least gain greater peace within their loss. So in that sense, they've made another step along, that they know why, or they know how they were killed, they now know which side released the missile. It's then a question of justice from there being carried out. So effectively, at the moment, we're saying, yes, we definitely know it's a Russian missile. And from this stage forward, we're going to work out exactly who said what to whom, why, and how, and then build the basis from there for prosecution. So in that sense, I see this is a big stepping stone towards that. And releasing it keeps it in the news, but it really has been released at this stage to be able to bring some form of closure or more closure for the relatives.
But so far, the Russians have floated lots of conspiracy theories, and already they're dismissing this new report as speculation. But the conspiracy theories that have been floated on Russian media and by the Kremlin include claims that the CIA filled a drone with bodies and crashed it in order to implicate Russia, and that the Ukrainians were trying to shoot down Vladimir Putin's plane but hit a civilian airliner instead. So these are the conspiracy theories that have been put forth so far. Is there any way that they can come up with any kind of conspiratorial theory to dodge this bullet that seems to be a fairly credible one?
Yes, I mean, both sides will sit there spitting at each other, which is always the problem with the investigators, that you need to have lots of different evidence. What you notice from some of the Russian stories is that it's changed about six times. As each one is discredited, another one pops up. Very quickly, when their press announced that the Su-25 Frogfoot from the Ukrainians had shot the aeroplane down, we all thought that they must have made a mistake in the press briefing, that it must have been the Su-27, which is a fighter, and not a low-level ground attack aeroplane, much like the A-10 Warthog in the United States, very useful for beating up tanks and flying in support of your infantry. But it doesn't fly up at airliner levels, and it doesn't really carry air-to-air missiles of that size. So that story was suddenly sort of changed and things like that. So I'm sure that various discrediting theories or distraction theories and political chest thumping will go on. But realistically, by forming an international team and saying, we'd like the radar data from Russia, please, we'd like it from all the other adjacent air traffic control units, just to be able to see what could be seen and brought about from there, you would normally see sort of three sets of radar data that were consistent from three different countries, let's say, and one set that wasn't, or three different radar heads. And you say, well, this is interesting. This may be a false set of data. And it's certainly possible to create that, to spoof radar data, should you wish to present it as your side of the story. So I think we have a credible investigation here, even though some of the more some of the political theories that come out will just be, as I say, to distract and deflect from the actual truth of what went on the day.
Well, of course, comparing the Netherlands to Russia, there's obviously an obvious disparity there, and I believe there's a trading disparity, that where the Dutch are somewhat vulnerable to Russian retaliation. But I recall that the first G20 meeting after the Malaysian airliner was shot down over Ukraine 2 years ago was in Brisbane, Australia, where Vladimir Putin was essentially ostracized by all the other world leaders. He found himself sitting alone at lunch and then was upset and then got on his plane and left early. So it would indicate to me that most of the world leaders have no illusions about who's responsible for this.
There were very significant indications from two or three different intelligence agencies, some of which would work cooperatively and share data, that this was a missile that had come from the rebel territory in eastern Ukraine. So I think that one had to sort of go with that sort of analysis, that they don't normally say, oh, it was definitely then. They don't normally make up that level. They're not always 100% straight. One has to admit that in terms of the intelligence agencies sometimes make up their own stories for their own political masters. But in this case, it would be quite unusual for all or several different agencies to align very quickly and say, oh, we blame the Russians, because at that stage, it was not necessarily evident to anybody else who hadn't been out to the wreckage site as to what on earth had caused the plane to crash in the first place. So the initial indications almost seemed to come from the intelligence agencies, which was then confirmed by looking at the wreckage rather than the other way around.
Well, just in closing, David Gleave, since you are in Dubai, I don't know whether you noticed, somewhat off the subject here, but whether you followed the recent presidential debate in the United States, but one of the things that caught my attention was when Donald Trump talked about how terrible our infrastructure here in the United States is, and he was praising the airports in Dubai, where you are, and saying that, you know, when you fly into LaGuardia or Kennedy, it's third world. And of course, this is a man who doesn't pay his taxes, so here he is complaining about the lack of government spending on infrastructure. Did you watch that? And since you're in Dubai, what was the local reaction to that kind of praise of their airports compared to here in the United States?
Well, I think the first thing is that nobody here, since Donald Trump decided to ban all Muslims in the United States, has taken him terribly seriously. His name has been removed from various billboards, and there's been a rebranding exercise of various businesses here in the property development world and leisure industries and things like that to remove all reference to him from here. Certainly, they're very proud of their airport here. And will be quite glad at the comparison that the United States, which is always shown by Hollywood to be the ultimate dream and the best of everything, that if he's praising things outside, that may well get reported in the press. But I don't think it's necessarily going to repair his image over on this side of the world.
Well, David Gleave, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good day.
Good day. And again, I've been speaking with David Gleave, who's the Chief Investigator for Aviation Safety Investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University. He joined us from Dubai. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the overwhelming votes in the House and Senate today to override President Obama's veto of a bill that would allow the families of the victims of 9/11 to sue the government of Saudi Arabia.
Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
Love is a woman on my block, just sits there, face in the hill, saying, who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna gonna take it?
Who's gonna take away?
Whose license to kill? Now he's hell-bent for destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Colleen Rowley, who's a former FBI special agent who in 1990 was transferred to Minneapolis. And in that office, she pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers Persons of the Year. And she retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colleen Rowley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Colleen, what did you make of the 97-1 vote today in the Senate to override President Obama's veto of the Schumer-Cornyn bill that would allow the 9/11 families to sue the government of Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's a long time in coming, over 15 years now, but it's a very good sign and a very good, I guess this was the very first time they voted to override any veto. So they picked a great topic. Like I said, long waiting. The 9/11 families have long been waiting for a bit of truth. You mentioned the Moussaoui case here in Minnesota. And really, that case, because it had, you know, obviously it had the discovery, it had the public exhibits, so you can still go and find all of the government's exhibits in that case. And that is one of the only ways we even know the little bit about 9/11, along with the 9/11 Commission report that we do, was because there was that public trial of Moussaoui. So we're looking forward that this case would really, through discovery, the parties get to ask for things and they get to make those things public. So I think a lot more truth is apt to come out if the case is allowed to go forward.
But in terms of the 28 pages that were classified from the joint investigation into 9/11 by the House and Senate that was chaired by Senator Bob Graham, who has really pushed for the declassification of those pages, they have been declassified, and in earlier, the field notes of the CIA and the FBI investigators was also declassified. I've read both those field notes and the 28 pages very carefully, and for the life of me, I don't understand why the press and just about everybody, and particularly the government, has dismissed those pages as sort of old news, or I mean, to me,
right. They're
just rife with smoking guns and paths not taken. Isn't that the real story, that these investigators generated these leads, but they were blocked at the highest level from pursuing them?
That's exactly right. They weren't dismissed as much as it was, to me, it was the cover-up, and I've said this many, many times, a lot of the other, you know, everything about 9/11 was initially covered up, and it took months and months even to get the first 9/11 Joint Intelligence Inquiry, where they did find these smoking guns that are now documented in the 28 pages. But then the 9/11 Commission comes along with Zelikow writing it, and he chose to completely dismiss any of it. He didn't even, I think he even fired somebody who tried to look into it further. And so that's where the cover-up occurred after that point. And Bob Graham, who was the head of the Joint Intelligence, one of the heads of the Joint Intelligence Committee, if it wasn't for him and the 9/11 families fighting for this, even 15 years later, and this is so important because all of our post 9/11 foreign policy now has been based on essentially on a lie that I'll tell you, this is an egregious lie, but they allowed people to sue Iran for 9/11. I assume it was maybe some of the 9/11 victims too. They allowed them because the State Department said it's okay to sue Iran. The State Department, of course, also went along with the United States attacking Iraq as being behind 9/11. Neither country had anything to do with the attacks. And yet, we've held them responsible. I mean, you see how messed up our foreign policy is, where you've held two countries responsible that had nothing to do with it. And on the other hand, because of this, because of what they claim is sovereign immunity, even though they themselves violate the nation state sovereign immunity all the time, they've not allowed the families to find out the truth, which is that Saudi Arabia had some involvement, at least some of its officials. You know, it may not have gone way up to the top, and that's exactly what this court hopefully will find out. I know we've only seen the Senate override, so we're still waiting for the House vote on that. But it would seem that the House would probably also go along with the Senate because it was such an overriding majority in the Senate. And also because this is really politically difficult now, especially after the 28 pages have come out and people now are beginning to know the truth. I think it would be very difficult now for a House representative to say, no, we don't want anyone to know that Saudi Arabia had anything to do with 9/11.
And again, I'm speaking with Colleen Rowley, who's a former FBI special agent who in 1990 was transferred to Minneapolis. And in that office, she pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers persons of the year, and she retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigations. It would seem, though, Colleen, that given the 97-1 vote in the Senate, and I'm pretty sure there'll be a similar vote in the House, doesn't that say that these 9/11 families, and particularly Christian Breitwiser, they have really done this country a great service, don't you think?
Yes, all along. And of course, their losses that they suffered were so terrible. When I testified to the Senate Judiciary, that was actually one of my main points, is that, you know, because people were saying, well, we don't need the truth. Even back then they were saying, well, you know, let's just gloss over this. And I was saying, and I said, well, of all the criminal victims I've ever come in contact with in the FBI, they never rest until they know the truth. And, you know, that's really why we have our courts of law. That's why we have a judicial system. Our whole judicial system is based on the idea that the victims eventually can learn the truth of what happened. And yet with 9/11, because, you know, there was a different foreign policy agenda, it was, you know, again, they just flip-flopped this backwards. I mentioned one thing about the foreign policy now with holding wrong countries responsible. But on the other hand, we've armed Saudi Arabia to the gills, $115 billion of arms just in the Obama administration, and they are using those arms now to bomb neighboring countries with our phosphorus and cluster bombs and everything else. And then we wonder why countries in the Middle East or people in the Middle East, we can't win the hearts and minds of the people. Can you imagine how wrong this foreign policy is? And a lot of it is because it's not factually based. There was no facts here. This was just determinations based on, you know, people making money and a lot of, you know, geostrategic reasons that they claim, but it was not based on facts, and that's what courts of law are for.
Well, when you speak of facts, though, in the 28 pages and in the earlier declassification of the field notes, some of the leads that weren't taken were pretty glaring. You know, for example, the ambassador, Saudi ambassador to the United States, who was a very powerful, influential figure in Washington, because the Saudis throw around a lot of money in public relations, and many, many senior State Department defense and intelligence officials, when they retire, end up on the Saudi payroll. I believe the former head of the FBI, Louis Free, is among them.
Yep.
I noticed that one of the leads was that the conversations between the hijackers and a bodyguard of Prince Bandar's, the Saudi ambassador's, at his estate in Aspen. I mean, you know, it's
right.
Pretty hard not
right.
to...
These,
go ahead.
These connections are right there. Now, it's true they were not allowed to delve further into finding out what those connections actually amounted to, but the communications are right there. You can look at who called who, and the hijackers in contact with the guys that were then in contact with the Saudi ambassador, who was close with the Bush administration. In fact, there's a photo of Bandar. They actually, his nickname was Bandar Bush because he was so close with the Bush family, and even going back to Bush's father and grandfather. They're sitting on the veranda of the White House. I think it's Condi Rice and Bush and Bandar and maybe Dick Cheney, like 2 days after 9/11. And like, they're all, I mean, you look at that photo and you say, what, something is wrong here. The whole country is in mourning and just shocked. And here they are meeting to plan their next steps. And again, this is sad that it's taken 15 years, but I think, you know, we hope that we will learn some more about this and that we can rectify all of these egregious mistakes that have been made in foreign policy that, frankly, have led to the deaths of over another million people. You know, not the 3,000 people who died on 9/11 haven't learned the truth, but now we've had a million more people that have been killed, and, you know, even millions more that have become refugees based on this really insane foreign policy that the United States adopted. Again, not based on any facts at all, just based on their prior political agenda that they had already written down. If they, you know, if they got a chance, this is what they wanted to do.
Well, the picture that you refer to with Prince Bandar and George W. Bush and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice shortly after the 9/11 attacks, what obviously was going on there also was the fact that the only planes in the sky after 9/11 were the Saudi planes ferrying Saudi families back to Saudi Arabia from the United States, among them relatives of Osama bin Laden. So that in itself is pretty extraordinary, don't you think?
Well, and Michael Moore brought this up in his movie. Apparently, Richard Clark okayed it. But if you mentioned this already, the Saudi money, and you're not talking millions. I think you're talking billions of money that really does go into the coffers of a lot of top politicians. The Clinton Foundation, of course, is just, you know, took millions of dollars from the top Saud family members. And this Podesta group, that is the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton, is actually one of them. There's two brothers. One of them is registered as a foreign agent for Saudi Arabia.
Right, the brother is. Yeah, he is.
Yeah, you can't get more. What's the word? You know, the corruption. You know, how can we even have our own country if we have other foreign countries with this much control? But they can, you know, again, change facts and get us to arm countries that are doing wrong things, and then keep the countries that have done the wrong things, you know, cover up for them. How can we even have a democracy?
Well, Podesta's brother is working overtime now because the Saudis have just poured a lot more money in to try and now they want to start influencing the House and Senate to overturn these veto overrides based upon the idea that there's a possible retaliation and reciprocity here from other countries who could sue the United States and its citizens abroad. So,
you know, that's a very weak argument, especially when, for instance, the United... I mean, I studied international law when I was in law school, and I even did a short term in Paris and Montreal and the Hague once. I agree. I am really definitely think nation state sovereignty, and that's where you get non-interventionism, because it's not fair of the more militarily powerful countries to just be able to, you know, walk all over another nation state just because they're smaller or weaker. So I'm very supportive of that. But what's happened here is the United States, in a whole lot of different ways, has not cared about nation-state sovereignty, simply because they believe that we're the policemen of the world. We're not a part of the International Criminal Court. So if other countries get hauled in there and they're held responsible, that's fine. But like Nixon thought, you know, since we're above it, you know, we're the most powerful, that we're above the law. And, you know, if we do get a lawsuit in another foreign country, and there has been some, for instance, Spain tried to assert universal jurisdiction over the CIA for torture, and then the U.S., you know, put a lot of pressure on the Spanish judge to get thrown out, etc. But But, you know, it's not a bad thing for countries to be held responsible for having done, you know, illegal, wrongful things. That's, in the first place, they should just be more careful not to commit the illegal acts to begin with. And a lot of those illegal acts absolutely were violations of international law and of nation-state sovereignty. So when they pull this up on the ninth hour to say, oh, now we're afraid that we'll be held responsible, it's very lame because they never thought about this when they committed all of these earlier, you know, war crimes like torture, et cetera.
So where do we go from now, do you think? I mean, to some extent, the momentum that Senator Graham had and others to get these 28 pages declassified has slowed. There's so many loose ends there. As we mentioned, much of what was revealed in these 28 pages really were the paths not taken, the leads that weren't followed down because they were blocked from above. And I'm astounded that somehow the press has lost interest in this. And I'm also always astounded at the people involved in the intelligence community who screwed up incredibly badly. You were one of the few heroes. You tried to point out that this guy, Zacharias Moussaoui, before 9/11, was learning how to take off a jumbo jet but not how to land it. And that was blocked. That inquiry was blocked at headquarters. So, and then you've got people like Allegra Butowski at the CIA who didn't pass on the information about the San Diego hijackers to the FBI. And there's just so many instances where 9/11 could have been prevented had the intelligence that was in-house been looked at properly and got into the right hands. So it just feels to me like we really haven't made much progress since 9/11.
Well, we haven't. Again, like I said, it's sad it's taken these 15 years just to get basically to step one. Now, where do we go from here? If the override prevails and if the administration, because we probably will be dealing with the next administration, and there will undoubtedly be an attempt, even if this override works, to get the case dismissed. And they'll try in two or three different ways to get the 9/11 family's lawsuit dismissed. They'll apply pressure. If one thing doesn't work, they'll just keep going. Because if the lawsuit goes forth, what they are afraid of is the facts coming out. And there's a lot of blame to go around. You mentioned the CIA, Bukowski. To this day, no one knows why they didn't tell the FBI. And they've been loath to really admit these things all these years. But if the lawsuit gets going, and if it is public, now the last thing they'll do is they'll try to make it all secret so that none of it is known to the public, and only the lawyers who have clearances will know the truth. That will be the very last resort will be that. They'll try to put secrecy over the whole thing. But I think they'll try two or three other ways to get the lawsuit dismissed. Now, on the other side, the families are represented by some really astute, good attorneys. I think some of them are former prosecutors, the former assistant U.S. attorneys themselves. And so they know how the system works. And so we can cross our fingers that this will go forward. And if it does, what will happen is when that truth comes out little by little, the press will have to cover it. I will be surprised if we're talking, you know, let's say a year from now, if there is discovery and some of these facts come out that the press says, no, that's not interesting at all to know this or that, you know, that Bandar paid this person. I really don't want to know. I'm still going to be an ostrich. I really will be surprised at that point once this comes out. I think they'll have to cover it. And then as a result of that, I think really some changes will have to occur. But there's still going to be a fight. There's going to be a fight, you know, if it's the Clinton administration for sure, because they have real strong financial ties to the Saud regime.
Well, of course, one of the big news organizations in the United States, Fox News, which is owned by News Corp, headed by Rupert Murdoch, the second biggest investor in News Corp is the Saudi Kingdom Fund. So... don't expect a lot of good coverage from Fox on this. I thank you for joining us, Colleen Rowley.
Yes, thank you for having me, and let's keep our fingers crossed.
Absolutely. Again, I'm speaking with Colleen Rowley, who's a former FBI special agent who in 1990 was transferred to Minneapolis, and in that office, she pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers persons of the year, and she retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties and the need for effective investigation. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the American exemption from sovereign immunity could backfire. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gregory Gores, who's the Chair and Professor of International Affairs at Texas A&M University. He is the author of three books, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Gores.
Thank you.
And there is a concern being expressed today, certainly by the White House, who suffered their first override of a veto, that America's exemption from sovereign immunity that the Schumer-Cornyn bill in the Senate now allows, given that the vote was overwhelming in the Senate, 97-1, and in the House it was 338-74. So what do you make of this idea that this newfound American exemption from sovereign immunity could backfire and that could expose the American government, its military, its citizens, and its corporations to lawsuits abroad?
I think that the White House makes a very strong case. There's no country in the world that's more involved in other people's business than the United States of America, from drone strikes to economic sanctions to regular diplomatic intercourse, to military bases, to all sorts of things. And the principle of sovereign immunity, I think, was probably, it protected American interests more than any other country's interests in the world. So being subjected to court proceedings, U.S. officials being subjected to court proceedings in other countries, I don't think that it will improve America's foreign policy.
But the U.S. has already had an exemption from sovereign immunity in naming Iran as a sponsor of terror.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people argue that Saudi Arabia, you can make a stronger case against Saudi Arabia than you can against Iran. So what did putting Iran on the list, if you will, on the blacklist, do in terms of the issue that we're discussing?
Yeah, I don't think that you can make a good case that from an American perspective, that Saudi Arabia is the equal of Iran in terms of being a state sponsor of terrorism. The Iranians are openly supportive of groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, which the United States has put on its list of terrorist organizations. Now, we can argue about whether that's a good way to make foreign policy, making lists of terrorist organizations, but that's the way the U.S. does it, and Iran openly supports these groups. There's no question about that. The Iranians don't deny it. I haven't seen any evidence of direct Saudi government support or Saudi support from high-level individuals in the government for groups that the U.S. has put on the terrorist list, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State. So I actually think from the perspective of American foreign policy as it exists now, you'd have a hard time saying that the Saudis are equally culpable with the Iranians. I think that the issue of lifting Saudi sovereign immunity in the case of the 9/11 attacks was a reaction to a couple of things. A very skillful lobbying campaign by 9/11 families. The fact that this is an election year, and the fact that, Saudi Arabia really doesn't have any friends in American public opinion for all sorts of reasons that are, I think, obvious. The Saudis are kind of the most illiberal country in the world, perhaps, and certainly don't share many social values with the United with the vast majority of people in the United States. And so it's they've got no defenders, basically, except the executive branch, which has always been the defender of the relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Well, that is, I guess, the question, or at least what the 9/11 families argue, that they say, well, you know, in spite of these joint hearings by the House and Senate committees on the investigating into the 9/11 attack, and, of course, the 9/11 Commission itself, that there needs to be a public airing, and lawsuits are the way that you get a public airing where the evidence can be presented and evaluated. What do you make of that case?
There have been congressional hearings at the 9/11 Commission that have been public. I'm not sure that we're going to learn anything new from a court case. The lawyers for the families can subpoena all sorts of people in Saudi Arabia. I don't think they'll show up in an American court. I'm not really sure how much more would learn. And then there's the whole question of if an American judge has a finding against the government of Saudi Arabia and starts to try to attach assets that belong to the government of Saudi Arabia, I think that that gets us into a very sticky situation. Because if you're talking about the ability of American courts to attach the assets of a foreign government that has a friendly relationship with the American government, I wonder about all sorts of other countries that might think that in a dispute an American court might attach their assets. And it does. This is the whole sovereign immunity issue. It opens up the United States to similar actions. I think that there are other venues in which this evidence can be treated. The 28 pages are now a matter of public record. It seems to me that it opens up real cans of worms when an American federal judge can start to decide on questions of foreign policy in the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Greg Grigoris, who is the chair and professor of international affairs at Texas A&M University. He is the author of three books, International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously, he was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, I remember back in the days of Ferdinand Marcos and his wife, Imelda, who had the enormous shoe collection, that weren't the Marcoses sued in the United States? And if you talk about the vagaries and whims of American courts, they were exonerated.
I don't recall that case, but my guess is they were probably, if they were sued in an American court, it would have been after he was deposed as president.
Oh, it was, yeah. It was. But she was, I think they were suing her because she was the beneficiary of his ill-gotten gains. But let's talk a little bit about why the families feel this way, about the 9/11 families, because there were 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. And in general, many people have made the case that this compact that the Al Saud family have with the Wahhabi sect gives you a kind of bifurcated government, and that leads to the possibility that the Mutawi, the religious side of this compact, could be off the reservation. In other words, the Saudi royal family have all this money and all these investments in the West. It doesn't make much sense on the surface for them to stab us in the back. But this kind of Wahhabi sect that clearly has inspired all kinds of radical movements around the world might well be, to some extent, an inspiration for a lot of the terrorism from Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, Al-Nusra, and the Islamic State?
I think you got to unpack that at a couple of levels. First, I think it's a mistake to say that there's a pact between the religious establishment and the Al-Saud family. The religious establishment are bureaucratic employees of the Saudi state, and the state has the upper hand. And if there were evidence that elements of the Saudi religious bureaucracy were directly funding 9/11 hijackers, then that would be a clear indication of Saudi state involvement. I haven't seen that. The most one might be able to take from the 28 pages is that someone who was a low-level Saudi employee in California met with a couple of the hijackers who were in California. I think if there were a concerted Saudi state effort to support the hijackers, we would have seen a much denser network of Saudi connections, of Saudi official connections to all 15 or all 19 for that matter. And so I'm not persuaded on that level. I think it's an extremely interesting question as to what role Wahhabism ideologically has played in the development of the Salafi jihadist movement, you know, epitomized by Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and the other groups that you mentioned, the Taliban, Boko Haram. I think you can make a very good historical case that the puritanical and conservative and very narrow interpretation of Islam that is Wahhabism played a role ideologically over time in the development of this Salafi jihadist movement. But I think that it was at that point that the Saudis lost control ideologically of it. And I think that really traces back to Afghanistan, where for the first time internationally, the Saudis encouraged violent opposition to a government on the basis of their religious ideology. And, of course, the United States was also supported that in the jihad against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. It's from there that you get bin Laden. It's from there that you get Al-Qaeda. And it's very interesting that almost immediately after the end of the Afghan jihad, bin Laden turns against the Saudis and the Saudi regime. And the Islamic State, which is somewhat, I would argue, somewhat of an inheritor of the Al-Qaeda line, ideological line, has declared the Saudi state to be its mortal enemy. The Saudi version of Wahhabism traditionally has been very supportive of existing rulers. Now, that's not surprising. It's a state religion, right? But I think they lost control of it as the Afghan jihad ended, and as this movement that was successful in the Afghan jihad developed a following throughout the Muslim world, not a broad following, not a mass following, but developed a following around the Muslim world that basically said, these guys have the answer to our political problems.
Well, I did speak a while back with the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Chaz Freeman, and he made the case that the countries in the Middle East should make it a priority and somehow get together and outlaw takfir, this religious exemption to kill in the name of Islam. And yeah. Is that a practical possibility? I mean, it was, of course, in Egypt, of course, was always where the Muslim scholarship was centered. But I think that Saudi money has moved a lot of the center of Islamic scholarship to Mecca and Medina, has it not?
I think that that's true. But we also have to remember there's another pole of religious learning and interpretation in the Muslim world right now, and it's in Iran, in Qom, and in the Shia seminary city of Najaf in Iraq. I think that this sectarian tension between the Saudis and the Iranians would make that kind of if you will, a religious consensus against declaring others non-Muslims really difficult to achieve. The Saudis and the Iranians are at each other for geopolitical reasons, and they use religion as an ideology in their fight against each other. If you could lower the temperature of the Sunni-Shia conflict between the Iranians and the Saudis, and concentrate more of the Saudi and other Sunni Muslim countries' efforts against ISIS and al-Qaeda, then perhaps you could have that kind of ideological development. But I don't see it as something that's going to happen in the short term.
But surely you can't bomb this problem away. And
oh, no, I'm not talking about bombs.
No, I know, but I'm just
talking about...
Sure, but I'm trying to find an alternative to the fool's errand of trying to bomb this problem away. You've seen in our presidential election a lot of simplistic and nonsensical talk about ISIS. So what would your prescription be in terms of a way to neutralize it at its ideological source?
I don't think the U.S. has much to say or do on that score. We're not a legitimate player in that conversation. I mean, that's a conversation within the Muslim world. And I think that we can encourage it. We can encourage our allies to have that conversation. We can keep the pressure on the Saudis to delegitimate ISIS and al-Qaeda within their own ideological framework. The Saudis have done some of that. I think we should keep the pressure on them to do more. And it's in their interest because these guys want to kill them. But I think that given the political realities of so many failed and failing states in the Arab world right now, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, Libya, it's easy for these kinds of small violent groups to attract followers, easier, I should say, to attract followers and to establish themselves on the ground in places where there's a civil war or the state can't control all of its territory. And so I think that the eventual demise of this kind of violent Salafi jihadist movement is going to come with the rebuilding of states in this part of the world. But that's not going to happen over months or even years. I think it's a decade-long project.
Well, Gregor Gause, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Gregor Gause, who's Chair and Professor of International Affairs at Texas A&M University. He's the author of three books, International Relation of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.